Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome back to Food Psych. This episode is a Q&A I shared on my other podcast, Rethinking Wellness. It went live there over 12 months ago, and I'm excited to bring it to you here now. If you want to get my most up-to-date content, please become a paid subscriber at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. Meanwhile, I can't wait to share this Q&A with you in just a moment. Intuitive Eating Fundamentals, the online course I created to help you make peace with food, is now available as an evergreen, self-paced course with lifetime access. It teaches you how to recognize and reject diet culture, take pleasure in food and stop fighting your desires, tune back into your body's signals of hunger and fullness, end the restrict binge or restrict rebound cycle, navigate emotional eating and learn new coping skills, and most importantly, I think, avoid turning intuitive eating into a sneaky diet. Sign up now for instant access to hundreds of hours of supportive content, including 13 modules on the principles of intuitive eating, deep dives into how to handle common issues that come up when you're trying to make peace with food, special meditations, journal exercises, and more. Get all the details and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course or click the link in the show notes. If you like this podcast, I think you'll love my newest book, The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook. I co-authored it with therapists Judith Matz and Amy Pershing, longtime leaders in the field of diet culture recovery, binge eating disorder, and trauma-informed care, who are also multi-time fan favorite guests on this podcast. We joined forces to create a workbook for clinicians and general readers alike that we hope will help you break free from the diet binge or restrict rebound cycle, recognize sneaky diets disguised as wellness plans, better understand the role food plays in your life and in managing emotions, unlearn harmful messages about what and when you're quote-unquote supposed to eat, dispel myths about weight, health, and wellness, and lots more. If any of that sounds interesting, you can learn more and buy the book at ChristyHarrison.com/workbook or click the link in the show notes. And now, without any further ado, let's get into it. Just a reminder that these answers are for informational and educational purposes only and aren't a substitute for medical or mental health advice. So with that, let's go to the first question. It's from someone named Christelle who writes, "Hi, Christy. I have horrible period pain and I got a recommendation to eat an anti-inflammatory diet. Is it a real thing? Does certain food really cause inflammation in the body? And also, do I really need to cut out gluten and dairy for my cramps to be less intense? Thank you so much for your job." So thanks for this question, Christelle, and I'm so sorry you're dealing with this level of pain. I know it's incredibly tempting when you have chronic conditions or a chronic condition like this to try to fix it with food, quote unquote, especially when nothing else feels like it's working. Unfortunately, in this and so many other cases, there's no good evidence to support using a quote unquote anti-inflammatory diet or cutting out gluten and dairy. In fact, doing those things could potentially make the situation worse. So a 2019 systematic review of observational studies from 1990 to early 2018 found that in general, there's no link between period pain or dysmenorrhea in medical jargon and most foods, though there is a link between weight loss dieting and meal skipping and period pain. Those things tend to increase the risk. In terms of gluten, the review found no association between painful periods and the consumption of pasta, rice, white bread, cookies, pastries, or grains, all of which typically contain gluten, though none of the studies specifically address gluten per se. But elsewhere, there's no research to support cutting gluten for general period pain either. One study does look at the effects of gluten for endometriosis pain, which I'll unpack in the answer to the bonus question. And by the way, all the studies that I reference here are going to be linked in the full show notes, which are available on Substack. So I will put a link to that in the podcast show notes that you can click through and get the full show notes with the study links. There's also no good evidence for cutting out dairy to manage period pain. So one observational study from 1997 found that although milk consumption didn't differ between people with dysmenorrhea and those without the condition, the painful period group did have a slightly higher cheese intake, but the difference was only 0.5 servings per week, and the researchers didn't actually collect information on portion size. They just asked people to estimate how often they consume certain foods, which is, of course, wildly imprecise, as most food frequency questionnaires used in nutrition research are. In fact, all of the other dairy-related observational studies included in the 2019 systematic review found that people who consume several servings of dairy a day are actually less likely to have painful periods than those who consume more. And of course, it's not possible for observational studies to tell us whether dairy actually has a protective effect. We'd need randomized controlled trials or RCTs for that, because observational studies can only tell us about correlation and not causation. But if dairy were a risk factor for period pain, we'd expect to see a strong correlation in the data, and we just don't. Speaking of RCTs, there are a handful of them examining diets for period pain, but none on gluten, dairy, or quote-unquote anti-inflammatory diets. So, Christelle, that means that whoever recommended those diets to you wasn't basing that advice on solid evidence, because, again, RCTs are the only form of research that can really tell us whether human beings should or should not pursue a particular clinical approach. And to answer your broader question, no, there really isn't very good evidence for anti-inflammatory diets in general, as I discussed in a piece that I wrote a few months ago, which we'll link to in the show notes as well. So RCTs, specifically those that are placebo-controlled and double-blind or double-masked, where neither the participants nor the researchers know who's getting the treatment and who's getting the placebo, are really the gold standard in biomedical research because they're the only type of study that can possibly determine if there's a cause and effect relationship between treatments and outcomes. You really need a placebo control to be able to do that. Yet even randomized controlled trials can have their limitations and should be examined critically, especially in nutrition science where placebo effects are rampant and also hard to control for. Take this one randomized controlled trial, which was published in 2020 in a low-impact journal, which is the first clue that it's probably not the most solid evidence. The study included 30 or so women who were assigned to eat dried figs during their period, another 30-ish who were assigned to take cinnamon mixed in warm water, and finally a placebo group that was assigned to take empty capsules. The study found that during the three menstrual cycles of the intervention, people in the dried fig group had lower pain severity and a shorter pain duration by about 7 to 8 minutes than people in the cinnamon and placebo groups. And the cinnamon group also had lower pain scores than those in the placebo group. But I don't think that's necessarily because of any special properties of dried figs or cinnamon for that matter. Instead, it might just have been because the placebo didn't fool people. Right? Empty capsules feel suspiciously light, which is why most placebo studies use capsules filled with an inert ingredient like sugar or starch. And when people figure out that they're getting a placebo, it makes it impossible to know whether the differences between the groups are due to the interventions themselves or simply to the fact that some participants believe they're getting an effective treatment and others don't. The placebo effect is really powerful, especially when it comes to pain, and so it can't be discounted and it has to be controlled for in studies related to pain. There are only a few other RCTs in this area, and most don't find any benefit to diets for period pain. The only other one I found that did is a small 2000 study conducted by doctors with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, which is a nonprofit advocacy group that promotes a vegan diet and an end to animal research. The study was published before conflict of interest statements were widespread in reputable scientific journals, but it probably would and should carry one of those conflict of interest statements if it were published today due to the clear pro-vegan agenda of the researchers. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given those conflicts, the study found that women who were asked to go on a low-fat vegan diet had about one less day of menstrual pain per month than those same women did on their usual diet plus a placebo pill, which they billed as a supplement. The researchers also used some unusual interpretations of statistical significance to claim that pain intensity was lower for people on the vegan diet. So for data nerds out there, the researchers deemed those intensity scores significant at p equals 0.05 instead of the customary p is less than 0.05, even though they used p is less than 0.05 in the rest of the paper. And the choice to reframe borderline but technically non-significant results as significant is interesting, to say the least. There's also this, quote, when asked to guess, 25 out of 33 participants believe the supplement to be a placebo, end quote. So again, the inert pill didn't fool people, right? Which means the so-called placebo group didn't really experience a placebo effect. And yet the intervention group did, because any diet that makes you feel like you're doing something for your health inevitably produces a placebo effect. And so that makes it difficult to know whether the diet had any benefits over and above a placebo. So in short, I would take the advice to modify your diet for period pain with a huge grain of salt, or maybe cinnamon. And given the potential links between painful periods and dieting, meal skipping, and perhaps other forms of disordered eating, going on a diet could even be counterproductive. The next question comes from Maria, who writes, hi, Christy. I've been following your food psych podcast for about 3 years now, and it has been an amazingly useful resource for me in recovering from anorexia and disordered eating. I have a long history of disordered eating and IBS, or irritable bowel syndrome. I started experiencing IBS symptoms at age 14, and I'm now 30, and I have just been diagnosed with endometriosis. As you can imagine, I've tried many things to help manage my bowel symptoms, cutting out gluten and dairy, going on food elimination diets, and more. Nothing has really eradicated my symptoms, although cutting out dairy does seem to have helped. Since going through the process of being diagnosed for endometriosis, and since having surgery to treat it, I've done a lot of research on how to manage endometriosis through diet. I was quite shocked to find that a lot of the books and online materials are riddled with diet culture. There are lots of recommendations to do a month-long food elimination diet, to give up alcohol, to follow a low FODMAP diet, etc. I don't really know where to start, and I'm quite worried about slipping back into anorexic behaviors if I follow one of those diets. Do you have any advice when it comes to endometriosis and diet? It's a minefield. So thanks, Maria, for that great question. And yes, it is a minefield for sure. So I'll start with the most important thing, which is that you say you're worried about slipping back into anorexic behaviors if you follow one of these diets. And in my view, that's reason enough not to do it, even if the evidence for those diets was airtight, which it's not, as we'll discuss. Unfortunately, many people who make diet recommendations, including many doctors, don't understand disordered eating or the very real risk that diets pose. And you know yourself better than anyone. So if you feel like relapse is a concern, I'd really encourage you to trust that. Your recovery is worth protecting. I know that for some people, in some cases, the possibility of escaping painful endometriosis symptoms might feel like it outweighs the risk of slipping back into disordered eating. And I have a lot of compassion for anyone in that place. And I'd also encourage you to consider how a diet might impact your overall quality of life, not just your pain. There's a paper on endometriosis and diet that I quote from in the newsletter version of this episode, and the authors write, a dietary intervention may be a lifelong change with social and financial consequences. If pain is alleviated after changing the diet, but the diet is expensive, not tasteful, and difficult to adhere to if not home cooked, it may not result in a higher quality of life. So in other words, it's really important to take the long view of, you know, of what this diet is going to do in your life, how it's going to affect you, and to think about the cost to your overall well-being in the long run. Now, let's take a look at the science. I haven't had a chance to scour PubMed the way I usually do in this kind of case, but as it happens, there's a 2022 systematic review of dietary interventions for endometriosis that did most of that work already. And it found that the existing evidence in this area is very limited, with mixed results and a high risk of bias. There was one 2012 study that did report an improvement in endometriosis pain for most patients on a gluten-free diet, but it wasn't randomized or controlled. Instead, doctors at one clinic in Italy assigned all of their patients to follow a gluten-free diet and had them self-report their pain on a scale of 1 to 10 at baseline and a year later. So like all observational studies, this one can only tell us about correlation, not causation. The gluten-free diet didn't necessarily cause people to have less pain, right? And the placebo effect comes into play anytime people go on a diet, as we discussed before, which is why it's especially important to have control groups and diet studies. When participants believe they're eating in a way that will help them feel better, that has significant effects on health outcomes, especially those related to pain. Pain is really amenable to the placebo effect. The 2012 study also has a high likelihood of bias and uses some problematic statistical methods. So it turns out that 88 patients withdrew from the study 2 weeks after starting the diet, citing side effects, including abdominal symptoms. And yet, those patients weren't counted in the statistical analysis, which only looked at the 207 patients who completed the study, of whom 75% reported a statistically significant change in painful symptoms, and 25% reported no improvement. So if the patients who withdrew were included in the no improvement category, the results would actually be much closer to 50-50. It would be 53% to 47%. There was also one study suggesting some benefit of the low FODMAP diet for endometriosis, published in 2017 by researchers at the Australian university that created the diet. In fact, the school has now trademarked the diet as, quote, the Monash University Low FODMAP Diet, TM, end quote, and offers online courses, product and recipe certification, books and booklets, and a very popular app for $12.99 to help people follow the diet, among other products. So I have nothing against people or organizations that sell books and online courses. Obviously, I do so myself. We're in a capitalist system. We all have to make a living, so that's fine. But when it comes to scientific research, those things can present a conflict of interest. So these days, I tend to look at low FODMAP research from Monash with the same skepticism as I would a study of Weight Watchers conducted by researchers on the company's payroll or a study of weight loss drugs done by the manufacturer, right? Conflicts of interest aren't always automatically disqualifying, but more research is needed from independent labs to confirm the results. This study also was not randomized or controlled, so the same problems with the placebo effect apply here. Of course, people are going to feel better when they're doing something they think will help, but is there any benefit to the diet beyond the placebo effect? We can't know without proper control groups. In terms of alcohol, one observational study from 2008 found that alcohol use was associated with a higher risk of developing endometriosis. And we don't know why, because that's just a correlation, right? So it could be a lot of confounding factors there. But there's no evidence that people who already have endometriosis will benefit from cutting out alcohol. This is yet another example of the correlation-causation confusion and conflation that often happens among doctors and the general public. It's completely understandable, especially in cases where there are no great treatments like with endometriosis, to want to try any quote-unquote lifestyle changes that might even have a remote chance of helping. So I get the desire to do that, but I think it's important to incorporate the side effects of those changes, like the very real likelihood of falling back into disordered eating, into your cost-benefit analysis. And when the science is as shaky as it is in this case, in my view, it just is not worth the risk. Thanks so much to everyone who asked questions for this episode. And if you want to ask one of your own for a chance to have it answered in an upcoming Q&A, you can go to kristiharrison.com/questions. If you found this podcast helpful, I'd be so grateful if you take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can see all the places to subscribe at kristiharrison.com/subscribe. It's kristiharrison.com/subscribe. If you're looking for help healing your own relationship with food, grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to kristiharrison.com/strategies to get it. That's kristiharrison.com/strategies. To get full show notes and a transcript of this episode, go to kristiharrison.com/foodpsych. And to get the transcript, find the episode page and scroll down to the bottom to enter your email address. A big thanks to Softer Sounds for audio editing and production. And to administrative assistant Julianne Witasik for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography, and the logo was designed by Melissa Alam. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs, and I'm your host and executive producer, Kristi Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and until next time. Stay psyched.